I'm Marie. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Marie.
When everybody's leading the podium, I'm going, God, don't leave me up here by myself. Then after hearing C.D. and Cornell, I told him out there, I said, who's supposed to talk next? God? I mean, you know. my sobriety date is March the 8th, 1979. And... I wanted to go into all that before that you say I'm grateful and thanks to this and thanks to that, but I knew I couldn't get it. But it's because of sponsorship and old-timers. And if you don't have an old-timer in your life, then you're cheating yourself. And I am nervous. Everything's kind of pinned together. I burned both my ears curling my hair. And my jacket was too short. I spent 20 years trying to show cleavage, and I've been spent the last almost 20 trying to cover it up. So if you're new in here and you're confused, just join the rest of us. We just don't drink a day at a time, and we learn about the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. I will sit down exactly 1 hour, and I am nervous, and Millie, an old-timer that died, used to say that I was nervous because it was God shaking the truth out of me. My first sponsor told me just because I'm honest doesn't mean it's the truth. It's just what I remember. So, and to this day, I asked George, when can I tell my real story? He said, not yet. And I would like to mention, you know, I am standing up here today, and I am... I have clean clothes on, and I look totally different than when I came. And by the grace of God, you've instilled values in me, and today I can be a lady. And I wanted that all my life. I wanted so bad to be like all of you and other people. And no matter where I was always different. I felt different inside. And today I know that I'm not different. Today I know that I found my place, and that's as an active member in Alcoholics Anonymous. And my, I came from an alcoholic, just an alcoholic life. Everybody drank. And my dad was what they called a wino, and he suffered from the disease. My mother reacted to the disease, and to my knowledge, there was never any Alcoholics Anonymous or Al-Anon for either one of them. And they had 6 children. And we all literally just grew up hating each other. And I'd wanted to run from that family all my life. And even as a little girl, I would sit and I'd figure out how I could kill these two people. For our home, there was no love. There was never any hugging or kissing, or I never heard my mother or my dad say, I love you, to each other. And because what came first in that family was booze, and that was never going to happen to me. I just was not going to live like that when I grew up. And anyway, my daddy, God bless his heart, he would get drunk every Saturday night. He'd go to jail just like clockwork. He went so much they made him the weekend county cook at the jail. And they'd come in and they'd say, Cecil, finish your wine. And we all had ten glasses, because we couldn't keep any glass in the house. Because, of course, you get mad, you throw the glass, and it breaks, and the 10 cups just bend a little bit. So, and anyway, they'd come and get him, and I always enjoyed that, because, especially in the summer, because somebody feels sorry for us, gives money, daddy go to jail, we'd go to the carnival or the circus or whatever was in town, and it was kind of like a brief holiday. And anyway, it went, things went from bad to worse, and I got it in my head that what I wanted to do was to run away from home and just be rid of all of them. So I would run away, the cops would catch me, and they'd take me home, and it just went on and on and on. Now, all this time, up until the time I came to AA, there was never anything wrong with me. I just had bad, rotten parents. And when I started getting sober, I started seeing where I had a part that I played in all that. And I can see where those character defects, as I know them today, started becoming a reality in my life. Because once I shoved all that self-pity and that ugliness aside and got to the truth, I found out that I wasn't who I thought I was. But anyway, I ran away, and my first attempt to drink, and I say attempt because I got drunk the first time I drank, was with moonshine. And you'll notice, I guess it's hillbilly twang. I'll go somewhere and they'll say, "Where are you from down south?" I'll say, "I'm from up north." And they never heard anybody talk like me from up north, so it's hillbilly twang. But anyway, I got to the place I'd run away, and my first drink, I was 13 years old, and it was moonshine. I remember drinking this and the room spinning, and that was it. And I'm not one that could sit down and be a social drinker. I never drink like a lady. I mean, when I'd start drinking, I'd go to jail, usually handcuffed and in a paddy wagon. And because I had so much violence, I was, I guess, a violent alcoholic. But anyway, finally I got to the place where I was on a hayride one night, and again, I had declared my innocence about everything, and it didn't really work. And so when I was 13 or 14, I was sentenced to a state reform school for 2 years and 9 months. And I loved it. I just loved everything about it. I just thought it was the greatest thing, you know. I felt like I was getting a private education. And while I was there, I sort of developed a little behavioral problem, like starting riots and ended up in straitjackets and stuff like that. And I can remember it was in February, and it was cold, and there was bars on the window, and there was no glass in them. And I can remember crying for my mother, this woman that I hated. I can remember crying for her. And I guess the point I'm trying to make is alcoholism in a family, it destroys every thread. There's just nothing left almost until you find a program like this. And my mother and dad would take turns going to mental institutions. He would go because he was an alcoholic, and then he'd come home. Then she would go because she suffered from the alcoholism, and it was just like I knew the day was going to come that they were going to write up those papers on me, and I was going to go. And my mother, bless her heart, they gave her shock treatments. They did all that. And so we just kind of all got used to somebody taking care of us, either the welfare or the mental people or the social workers or somebody. And that didn't change. Long after I was in AA, I thought y'all were supposed to look after my every need, but y'all fixed that. But anyway, God, I cannot believe I lost my place. Dot Mooney always said when she lost her place, hell, there's plenty of starting to pick from. But anyway, I went to the reform school, and I stayed there, and they paroled me, and I never will forget the first night I came home. Nothing had changed. My mom and dad had moved 7 times in 3 months, and the living conditions were the same, rats, roaches, and the whole deal. And I remember my mom handed me $1.25, and she said, "Go get yourself a 6-pack of beer." And I remember, and that's basically probably what I did, but I went back and I told, I found this judge, and I told him, he thought it was a little strange, he'd never had a request like that, but I told him I wanted to go back to the reform school. And he didn't think that was a good idea. And most of my life has been from one extreme to the other. It's never been an easy flow from anything into anything. And so when I went there, I told him that I wanted to go back. And to make a long story short, they sent me off to a cloistered monastery. I need some water. I was in the reform school, I worked real hard at becoming one of the worst. Well, if you were the worst in the school, that meant that you were bad, and that meant that you were good. You figure that out. But anyway, so when I went to the convent, I had to try to become the best girl in the school, and I went about things the wrong way, and I'd sneak over into the nuns' private quarters, and no one was allowed there, and do things like that. And even in the convent, they found ways of locking you up. But it was one of the few times in my life that I ever knew any peace. And, of course, I had those visions of me becoming a nun. That's when it started there. And I remember in particular one time they invited the Jesuit College, the students from the Jesuit College to come over, and we had a little tea for our junior-senior thing, and how I got in trouble because I was the only girl in the whole school that kissed her date goodnight. And I didn't feel like I should let an opportunity like that pass, you know. Because I never had a lot of time to date. I was always locked up. But anyway, while I was there, my mother would write me letters that she was dying with leukemia, and she never had leukemia. And this relationship I had with my mother was torture. It was just torture for me. And I know that you alcoholics understand fully a love-hate relationship. But it was almost, if you can believe this, 50-50, hate and love. But it was bad all the way around. And anyway, it got time for me to leave this school, and I graduated and did real well. They wouldn't let me go back home. So they decided I could go live with my aunt up in Ohio. So I went up there, and, it just didn't work out there either. Because I heard a lot, I was just like my mother, and I have told you how I felt about my mother. Even George has never said you're just like your mother. But anyway, something happened one night, and I got me like a little pint of bourbon, and next thing I know, they were moving me clear out. They didn't move me out of that house. They moved me out of that town. They took me from Willard, Ohio, to a little town called Shelby, Ohio. And got a little place up there, and this was in 1963, and two people that more to me, and I mean this, anyone in the world was John Kennedy and Dr. Kildare, and I had their pictures, and he had that little Nehru collar, and I lived in a world of fantasy. You know, in the back of the book, that chapter called How to Handle Sobriety talks about we must reject fantasy and begin to accept reality. And I've just kind of started doing that in about the last 8 years. It took me a long time because I could get by with all that in my head. But anyway, at this time, of course, Kennedy was assassinated. And I remember how devastated I was because Jacqueline Kennedy was everything I wanted to be. I mean, everything. I just loved the little kids and, of course, I adored all her money, you know. And I mean, anyway, when he got killed, I remember I just locked myself up and I just drank and drank and drank. And I remember going to a party and it was snowing, and I thought what I need to do is just give my life to God. And I went to a monastery and was going to become a sister. And I went in and I talked to Mother Superior, and thank God that they wouldn't have had me anyway, but maybe by a slip they might have taken me. But she told me when I found my place in this world to come back. And of course I have found my place in this world. But so I left there, and I don't know that I felt rejected or anything. I remember feeling like Joan of Arc trudging through the snow, and what an opportunity they had missed, that type thing. So anyway, I made arrangements to come back to West Virginia, and I sent all my stuff, went back on a Greyhound bus, and when I got back, the cab driver, I gave him the address, and he said no one lived there. The address I'd given him had been condemned. So anyway, I went into this strange woman's house saying, Mom, I'm home, and it wasn't my mother. Anyway, he did take me to the place that was condemned, and I went there, and again, nothing had changed. And so what did change was it was an old store in the front. I got it, had, still do, a lot of pride. And I remember the big old concrete porch caved in and made the front page of the newspaper. And I'm thinking, God, what else is going to happen? And the sad part about that was, and a real awakening for me that I've held on for years, is when I went downstairs underneath there, I saw it was 2 or 3 foot just piled high of Solox paint thinner cans. That's what my dad had resorted to drinking. And I don't know why he didn't die from that. But when you're an alcoholic, you will drink anything. My neighbor came over the other day and wanted to borrow some vanilla. Now, I'm a drunk that I take no chances, so I'm not up here to argue or pro or con anything. I know what works for me. And I said, God, I've got some vanilla in here I'd love to give you because I use the imitation. She said, what do you mean? I said, well, there's been times this has been a good drunk for a lot of people. You know, 97% alcohol. If I'd known about it, I'd have done it. But anyway, lost my place again. Where was I?
The porch caved.
The porch caved in, thank you. So, how could you forget a porch caving in? But anyway, so what I did, I got in my head that what I needed to do, and the fussing and the fighting was still going on, and Daddy would lose 3 pints of blood from hemorrhaging, and the church would come and save him, and he'd give his life to God till he could get down to the liquor store and get some more Four Roses, and that's about as long as it lasted. So I got in my head that what I needed was a baby. I needed something to call my own, and I didn't have a boyfriend, didn't have a husband, I just wanted a baby. And back then, I tried to keep it clean from the podium. I was a virgin. I was proud of that. I thought, this is what you live for. And like I said, I was locked up all the time. I didn't know what the deal was, or I'd had probably 24 kids. But anyway, we stopped at this little drive-in restaurant, and I never will forget, this guy walked up, and he had a 50-model Ford station wagon. We called it a Sky King, and he had a tooth knocked out. He had a black eye. He was drunk, and he was on crutches, and he said, I had pretty brown eyes, and I got pregnant, and I got married. That's just as a matter of fact, his mother, her husband, me and him both got married the same night, and it was truly an old-fashioned shotgun wedding. That's what it was. Because I was supposed to be going to an unwed mother's home and back when they were popular, and I didn't want to do that. And that night he took me home. After he took me out and got me hot dogs, and this is the God's truth, and French fries, and he had to get me home because he had a date that night. And I collected Tupperware, and I called it my hopeless chest. And that's what it was, you know. It's amazing when you're an alcoholic woman how you'll just, I've just felt so blessed to have his name. I didn't have nothing else. I mean, when we got married, they looked at him and said, say to her, to thee I endow all my worldly goods. He never said it, and I never got it. I mean, it was just, and I didn't know that I was marrying a full-blown alcoholic. I had no idea, because I was trying to be this prim and proper. I was always a wannabe at everything, you know. I had little white jackets and little pleated skirts and just a picture of purity, you know. And anyway, he had a couple of severe allergies that I found out about later, and one was working and the other was women. And he ended up, and we found out about the last one 2 years ago, having 15 children, and two of them were mine. And so he was a busy boy. I said they could use him. I'm going to keep his clean, Cornell, for Viagra commercials. I mean, he just... So anyway, the day came, I would do things like... I used to not like Al-Anons, and I have certainly changed over the years because some of them are very close to me today. But I certainly identify with them because some of the things I would do, I'd lay all these socks out on the bed and I'd clip the toes out of every pair of them. I would lock him, he would lock himself up in the bathroom and I'd get the hammer and try to pound him out of there. And to my knowledge, the guy never struck me first. You know, I would get the lightweight part of the Electrolux cleaner and start on him. And usually I won. But anyway, I guess I should have looked at Dad when I was doing my inventory. Maybe he had reason to do what he did. But anyway, things went from bad to worse, and he decided his place was with a redhead, and they took off together. And I had 2 children by that marriage, and when one was 5 months old and the other was 3 years old, his mother came to get him and to look after him, and I never got those children back, and have just... started the relationship in sobriety with both of them. And So anyway, everything was just all messed up, and so I thought what I need to do, prior to this, right before he left, there was a whole series of events happened that I used to stay drunk for 11 years. Now, I did not know that what I know today about self-pity. I did not know that. I didn't know that that's all I was living on. I just really didn't know that. But anyway, I was watching TV one morning, and a picture of this little girl come on there, and it happened to be my little 9-year-old baby sister, and they found her murdered and raped. I remember my dad telling me, coming in for the funeral, said he was going to kill himself, and 21 days later he did. My brother went to Nam. He never came back. The other brother got shot down. I lost a baby. I had my mother committed. And so what I got at my head was I needed to be somewhere where I didn't have to think. Now, this is alcoholic thinking. I wanted to drink was what I wanted to do. I wanted to do something to make that guilt go away about those children. And I'm here to tell you that I successfully done away with my guilt until I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. Because by the time I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I had absolutely rationalized every rotten thing I ever did. And I did not have that guilt. I didn't have guilt with my children because it was their daddy's fault. And I didn't have guilt with anything because it was always somebody else's fault. It almost killed me when I found out that it was me. And it was not all those other people. And that kept me sick for a long time in this program, that refusal to see what we call that invisible column in the book, my part in it. You know, and finally I found my part in it. But anyway, so what I got in my head was I needed to do was get another job. And I'd always had good jobs, but now I wanted a little different job. And there was an ad in the paper, and it was for bunnies. And I thought, well, you know, I have to work hard at just passing attractive. So I did everything I had to do, and I went up to this fancy nightclub, and I couldn't believe it. I got hired. And so there began my, whatever you call it. If you're drunk and you're out there, you know, it's a, I don't know what it is. It just was there. And I started going to jail. I got into a whole lot of things that normally I wouldn't be involved in. And we do tell everything in a general way, and I have literally been under the little white lights where you couldn't see the people on the other side, and I actually got myself in some very dangerous situations. And all this time, drinking, and I never knew. I know Dr. Silkworth says I drink because the effect produced by alcohol, but when I was drinking, I drank to just make everything go away. And most of the time it worked for me. But anyway, this job, I had gained a lot of weight, and I wasn't as popular as I thought I was. Well, in the end, nobody wanted anything to do with me. And I know today that when I would walk into a bar and I would say hello, why everybody jumped to speak, because if they didn't, I would tear up the place. And it was worth it to me to go to jail just to get their attention. That's how sick I was. So again, with my life, one thing leading to another, so a woman came up to me and she said, why don't you come to work for me? And I thought, oh, I could never do that. But anyway, I did. So I left the club scene and went to work for the Girl Scout Council. It's a true story. And I wore the little green uniform and the little flyer, the scarf, and my insurance reports would come in the office, possible OD had been drinking, or I'd come in where some wife that didn't understand anything would slam my leg in a car door. God, I mean, for, you know, just being with her husband, I didn't understand that. Eventually I left, and alcoholics always find good jobs, and I left there, and went to work for the governor's office. If you're seeking attention the way I always tried to get attention, I really thought I had arrived. And anyway, I managed to stay with them for about a total of 5 years, the drinking got worse, the situations got worse. I never had a decent relationship. I'd have these brief engagements, and then they would get me somewhere and say, I'm not marrying a suicidal maniac, or a fiancé would walk in and I'd be kissing his best friend and stuff like that. And because I lived in that world where nothing mattered but that drink. That drink came before anything. It came before my children. It came before any relation. It just came before anything. And so anyway, we'll get to my last drunk, and it was in Wheeling, West Virginia. And by this time, some guy had moved me out into a little two-room efficiency while I was at work. He moved me from one end of Westford to the city of Charleston to the other end. I guess that was far enough away, but I had no car. I gradually was losing everything, and I remember being in Wheeling, and I told my boss I had to go downtown. I had to drink. I no longer could I go all day, I guess, without drinking. And I remember going to the ABC store, and I got a fifth of vodka, and I told my boss I'd meet her there, and I met her. I went down there, and I had two, like, double Bloody Marys, and I didn't feel anything. And then I went downstairs and took the plug off of that big old jug, and then I started really putting her down, and that's the last thing I remember. I know that I had a week's drunk. It had never happened to me before. I would just pass out and come to, pass out and come to. And the only thing that I ever knew about Alcoholics Anonymous was a movie I'd seen called A Days of Wine and Roses. And for some reason, I mean, I didn't even know that AA existed in the state that I lived in. I had never seen it anywhere. I'd never talked to anybody about it. So I do believe in the miracles that CD was talking about. And anyway, I had this little two-room efficiency, and the window was about that far from the floor. And after I got sober, I identified with Bill when he talked about he took that mattress and lowered it to the floor for fear he'd go through the window sash and all. And I thought that could happen to me, too. But anyway, I picked up the phone trying to do it different, because when I'd have my suicide attempts, and I had four, I'd call everybody up and tell them what they had done to me, and it was their fault. And I know today inside I was hoping they'd get there before anything really happened, because I thought, you know, if I could shake them up a little bit, because I am such a coward. I don't ever want to die. You know, even to this day, I'm better with the fear of dying than I used to be, but I simply ain't ready. You know, so I tell my husband all the time, if something ever happens to me and they got that cord they pulled, leave mine plugged in, you know, forever. I was going to catch her. I said, where was it that time? She had to think. But anyway, I picked up the phone, and I got to tell you about this little place I had. It wasn't probably as big as that little podium over there, and I had this going love affair with Jimmy Swaggart. I thought that was the sexiest man that God ever made, and especially on Sunday mornings, and sometimes he's on late at night, I'd have my drink, and he'd say, touch this television, and I'd touch that television, and I mean, me and him just, and I thought if he had somebody like me, and... I got to tell this about Cornell. I was in the bathroom telling one of the girls I sponsor. I said, you know, I used to have a bad crush on Cornell. I thought he needed to be married to me. And a lot of us get crushes on these old timers, but Virginia, you know it's all right today. Anyway, I told him, I said, to call AAA. That's all I knew about. And the next thing I know, I heard this woman. There was two women that came, and I heard this one clomping up the steps, and she said, Al-Anon hell, that's an alcoholic if I ever saw one. And so she came up there, and I had this bed that folded out, and I remember standing there pecking on this piece of wood, trying to figure out how to fold it up and put it in my hide-a-bed. Now, I didn't know I was going into having the hallucinations. And I'd bought this nightgown, and it was pink, and it went all the way to the floor, and in big blue letters all the way down the side, it said, "Baby, light my fire," and that's how I went to detox. And so anyway, I got down there, and I got in detox, and this guy come up, and I said, "Are you an alcoholic too?" And he said, "Yeah," and they handed me they detoxed me with Librium and whiskey, and when they handed me that, I am in an all right place, you know. And he was the director, and he was a recovering alcoholic, and I had something there a few days later that probably kept me sober my first year. It was something they called delayed DTs, and the things I saw, my God, and what I went through, it literally, fear kept me sober for the first year in Alcoholics Anonymous. And if you're still drinking or you think it can't happen, it will. Just keep drinking. And I swore if I ever got through that day at a time, I'd never want that to happen to me again. But anyway, the women came and they started talking to me, and they said that wanted me to go to a meeting. I said, "Well, I'll go, but you're not forcing me to go to any meetings." Well, they showed up for the one of the meetings that was in the detox, and I was embarrassed. I had that, you know, that pride, and it was a clinical situation, and people could come in off the street, and some guy was talking about his Jeep being up in a tree, and I'm thinking, he needs to be here, not me. And I had this multicolored Chinese robe on, and I had long hair, and it was over here somewhere, and I couldn't hold coffee. And I remember at the end of that meeting, there was two big burly men, and I tried to physically wrench away from them because I didn't want them holding my hand, and how they held on to my hand. And I took the March the 8th as my sobriety date. I think it was 3 days after my last drink, and I think a lot of us, you know, get into that. I want to do it perfect. Anyway, I got out of detox, and they picked me up on a Friday night for the meeting. They didn't even recognize me because I had cleaned up, and then they took me to Dunbar to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I remember the first thing I thought about you people were, you didn't care about me because you didn't ask me a bunch of questions. All you did was talk about yourself. And I thought, well, you don't care about me. And then someone asked me, made the mistake of asking me to share, and I was trying to explain to them a sexual situation. And I started getting the elbows, and of course I finished, and the group, God bless them, they tolerated me. And then at the end of that meeting, some well-meaning member came up to me and started giving me that lecture, that 13-step business, you know, and I listened to him, and I sort of thanked him and went on about my business. Then we all went to eat that night, and things fell apart at breakfast, and no one paid any attention to me. You know, you could be dying in AA, and they'll say, "You'll get over it. Don't worry about it." And I mean, I was shaking, milk spilling, and oh, you'll be all right. But anyway, I got home at night, and I got a phone call from somebody 13 years sober, and George always asked me to please say it wasn't him. But now, I'm about 8 hours out of detox, and in Alcoholics Anonymous about 8 hours, and this guy on the other end of the phone says, "Would you like someone to come up and watch TV with you?" God, of course I would. And so he came up, and he started going through the history, you know, and couldn't help but reflect. See Sister Ignatia, Dr. Silkworth, and all this stuff in here. This is what he started talking to me about. Of all things, the history of AA, and the only way I can say it, clean it up the best I can, and let you know what happened, is that everything I needed, I got that night through injection. And so I would go around to the meetings, and I had Mr. AA on my arm, and I would see the looks that some of you sober women would give me, and of course you were just jealous. You didn't want me to have anything, and you were too old to have anything yourself, and you didn't care what really happened to me, and it just got real sick. But I understood later where they were coming from. When I was coming out of a meeting one night, I call it my early sleaze. You know, I had that purple and skin-tight jeans on and 4-inch heels and really working at being sleazy. And takes a while to get out early sleaze, in case any of you identify with that. But anyway, the guy I was with ducked down, and it sounded like somebody's letting firecrackers off. So when he ducked down, I ducked down too, and he started running on it like a duck. And so I didn't know. I just started doing the same thing he was doing. This is the truth. And what had happened was his ex-wife had let off 6 bullets over my head. And you know, we all have reasons to stay sober. I don't know what yours are, but I know what mine are. And so right down, anyway, I raised up, and she had that gun pointed at me. It was a yellow car. I'll never forget it. And I found out she was a crack shot. By the way, I have never considered that lady to be a good member in Al-Anon of any standing. They just sort of have a little problem if you running around with somebody belongs to them, you know. So if you think you can get by with it, you'll get drunk. Please don't. But anyway, I ran down the boulevard and I ran the wrong way. And when I went to the wrong way, she caught me, and I just knew I was going to, in my mind, I don't mean to sound dramatic, but I was thinking, where's that bullet going to hit? What's it going to feel like? And anyway, there was the bar that I frequented right down the road, and I went down there, I was going to go down there, and that was the first, I think, conscious thought I had, do I really want to stay sober? And I did. Anyway, I called a taxi cab driver, and I had to convince him to take me home. They don't want to pick you up. Somebody's been shooting at you. So anyway, he picked me up, and he took me home, and then, of course, I talked to the guy, and I talked to the lady, and I told her she'd get help. I wouldn't press charges. Oh, how sick I was. Anyway, I got what most of us gals get when we go that route in Alcoholics Anonymous. I got that phone call that his place is with her, not with me. And by the grace of God, I stayed sober. Now, I'd like to say that I was at the last place in the world I had to go. And I also want to say there was no credit to him that I stayed sober. You know, this 13th step, and it can be lethal. It can be lethal in Alcoholics Anonymous. And in our group, and I'm a member of the Primary Purpose Group, and I believe I belong to one of the finest groups in the world, our women are at the last place they have to go. So in our group, if any guys come in there and they want to put the make on them, they're going through the women first. And they know that right up front. And that has worked for almost 16 years because there is nowhere else to go except a grave. Later on, I called this woman that I hated, that old bag that never wanted me to be happy in AA, and I called her up, and I was crying, and I said, you told me if I ever wanted to get sober to give you a call. And I remember she came and got me. They took me to a meeting, and on the way back from this meeting, which was way out of town, I remember seeing all these church steeples. And for some reason, I kept saying, if all of those people can believe in something, why can't I? Why? I just, you know, all my life I had that God that I was terrified of, and that hellfire and damnation. And then I come into AA, and y'all say, but you have to love God. Well, I didn't know how you loved something and hated it at the same time other than my mother. I didn't understand it. So gradually, I got with this sponsor. We started going through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, and she literally saved my life. That woman gave everything to me. She made time for me. If I was having some sort of problem, she helped me find a solution to it. She took me to meetings. She took me to conferences. She got me involved in service. All those selfless, selfless things. And I can't tell you the times that I was critical of her, the times that I wish she wasn't in my life when I was getting sober. And today I still have a beautiful relationship with that woman. I stayed in AA, and eventually I ended up in another relationship. And again, this guy had 13 years. I don't know what it was, me and 13. But anyway, we dated 6 weeks, and we got married. And we went to, I guess the difference was that I was working the steps the best I could. And so if I sponsor somebody and they're wanting in a relationship, I don't say wait a year. I say wait till you get through the first 9 steps. Because I was taught that the first 3 teach you about God, that 4 through 9 teach you about a relationship with yourself, and then 9 or 10 through 12 teach you how to have one with other people. So as a result of that, most of the gals that I sponsor, they're always working those steps so they can, you know, move right on. But today I'd like to tell you that I have a relationship with a man that I love beyond my wildest dreams. And it doesn't mean relationships don't have problems. And I've had some tough times in Alcoholics Anonymous. I can remember a time when I was 8, 9 years sober, and I was waking up every day, and I didn't care if I lived or I died. And yet I was sponsoring people. I was involved in service. I had old-timers in my life. I was just doing all this stuff on the surface. And I remember an old-timer coming to me, and he said, Marie, he said, there's such a difference between action and activity. Because, see, I was doing everything for you all to see it, and I wasn't doing anything on the inside of me. And it almost killed me. About 4 years ago, I went through a situation that happened in my life when adversity hit, and all of a sudden the fear came back, the pride came back, and I never felt so alone in all my life. And the reason I say that is because that's where self-centeredness took me, to where what is going to happen to me, and it's all about me, and how am I going to deal with this, and blah, blah, blah. And totally got into wanting to punish somebody else for getting sick. And I can tell you this today, that God has been good to me, because He has almost allowed me to forgive myself for that, for the person that I had almost become because things weren't going my way. You know, I've been given the gift of sobriety, and I can't stand up here in an hour and tell you of the true miracles that have happened in my life, but I can tell you this. I never waltzed into Alcoholics Anonymous and said, I think I want to change my life and get better. I fought and I kicked and I screamed. I was one of those that said that some of these we balked, and I did. And I never wanted to be who I was. You know, I walked around out here today, and I truly in my heart, and I mean this, I said, God, there's a new girl out there today that don't know there's another way to live. And that's why I'm behind the podium. Because there's so many people, especially I know in our home group, because I go there, that have a far better message of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's just wherever the coin lands. That's how it is. So anyway, I wanted to tell you about those two little girls that I have. One of them I have a good relationship with, a wonderful relationship with. The other, I'm still working on it. And it's the first year that I've ever talked to her twice. And I've talked to her twice this year. And that in itself is a miracle. My husband today, I, you know, it's like somebody else said, you know, I'm learning how to love, and I'm learning how to be loved, and I guess there's some people out there that think, well, you're sober almost 20 years, you should have all this together. I don't. I learn how to live on a regular basis daily, and whenever these things come in my life, I do what I did when I first came to AA. I pick up the phone, I call my sponsor. I'm blessed with a lot of women in my life who are there for me. I had surgery a couple years ago, and I couldn't even walk. And I have a girl I sponsor, and she, for 6 days and 6 nights, she never left my side. Of course, I hated it when I got better. I got used to that, you know, but but that's what you get in Alcoholics Anonymous, is that unconditional love that's rendered in here. And, you know, when I think about something that happened to me last January, it was never supposed to happen to me in a million years. Again, the total self-centeredness. Things, one day I was going to make things right. One day I was going to have that woman who had, I've been married 19 years and my mother's never been to my house. Not one time. And I had an Al-Anon tell me one time, she said, my God, Marie, said, you see a stranger sometimes twice in 10 years. You know, and it was that inability to truly, truly, truly forgive and be forgiven. And in 92, I went up and I made my amends to my mother again. It was the second time. And I think what I did was I didn't follow up. I didn't continue to write. I just thought, well, I've done what I'm supposed to do, so be it. But if it's not right inside, then it's not a so be it. And last January, she died. And she wasn't supposed to die. And I went back to West Virginia. And it was kind of uncanny because there we were dressed alike, and here was a woman that I had never, ever, ever truly known in my whole life, because I didn't want to know her, because I was ashamed of her. And if you're hearing a little bit of guilt, I'm still dealing with it, and I can talk about it, because I know that the day's going to come when it's going to be okay. And I remember I took her hand, and my daughter was there, and the only people that had come to visit or see my mother for her whole entire life was one little black family that fed us when we were children, and I loved them. And that was all that was there to bury my mother, was that one family. And I remember thinking to myself, and my daughter was there, and I touched my mother's hand, and I said, do you think she knew I loved her? Because I did love her. I didn't know how to show that I loved her, but I loved her. And I remember at the funeral, the minister started reading this beautiful, beautiful poem, and it was called A Silent Love. And at the end of it, when he got all through it, it was signed by my daughter. She had taken the time to write that. And I asked her, I said, what made you write that? She said, when you were standing there and you said, I wonder if she knew I loved her. You know, that's when she was able to put that together. She, this daughter who I had never raised in my whole life, could understand what I was dealing with on the inside. You know, and today when I think about the situation with my mom, I believe today the healing's taking place. And I believe that selfishness that I have inside of me, I think I'm going to go to my grave with it, but I think it's going to be put in a position where I can deal with it, and maybe it won't be as bad as it can be. And I am just, you know, that other daughter, her and her sister do not talk to each other, the whole family scattered all over the place. And what I do is I go to my home group, and I read my big book, and I try to practice the principles and most of my affairs on a daily basis. And I never had that before. And I think what Alcoholics Anonymous is about is hope. You know, is coming here and saying, if they can get better, maybe I can get better. You know, I have been this, I'm going to tell you this, I'm going to brag about this. For years, I can't remember the last time I was out of debt. We refinanced our house, and I want you to know I am just about debt-free. I cannot believe it. And I used to take that big book where it talks about, because drunks owe bills, and we make bills. And in that book it says you must lose your fear of creditors. Creditors, no matter how far you have to go, because we might drink. You know, and that part about when I was new, I wanted to make all that money. You know, and the book talked about that we find it dangerous for the man who rushes headlong into his economic situation. And the most appealing phrase, and I love this phrase, and I love those one-liners, is when we built our house, and I was 4 years sober, and J.P. and I were out in front of the house, and I looked at that, I said, I can't believe that's mine, because I'd always lived in poverty. Now, being in AA, things start to happen. And he said, Marie, don't you get it? He said, material well-being always follows spiritual progress. It never precedes. And I started thinking, if I continue today to get right with God and put AA first and put that drunk first, no matter if it's inconvenient or no matter if I've got plans to go to the movies, you know, this thing of 12-step and people over the phone, you can't do it. You got to go. And I have always been taught that. I got a lot of things about a lot of guilt, but I don't have any about working with new people, you know, or even old people, because that's what stays in my life on a daily basis. And I was asked to come to this conference, and somebody says it's hard to talk in your hometown. And I'm going to tell you something. I have felt so much love here this weekend. And when I walked in here yesterday and I saw Sister Ignatia and Bill and Bob and Dr. Silkworth and our literature, and the place was empty, it was like a tabernacle to me. And I wanted to sit in here and thank Bill and Bob and you people for what you've done to me and for me. See, you're still doing things to me. And I have my sponsor's not been doing real good, and I've had the same sponsor now for about 16 years, and I love that woman with all my heart, and I can't get into that, but you know, if I had my way, she'd be living with me. She'd be right here so I could take care of her, because I couldn't do for that mother for whatever reason. But you know, I got a lot of ladies in Alcoholics Anonymous that thought enough of people like me to not leave AA when they wanted to leave or things got bad. They stood in here. They stayed here so that whenever a drunk like me needed this program and was forced here under the threat of practically dying, that I would have a place to come. And all I want to do is be able to do that same thing for you. Thank you.